WGTE Public Media in Toledo. This is Storied Ground, a Northwest Ohio history podcast, where we visit our region's many historical sites and markers to rediscover the presence of the past around us in all its wonder, diversity, and complexity. I'm your host, Nick Pavlik.
We have now fairly turned our backs on the old world and find ourselves in the very stream of emigration. Old America seems to be breaking up and moving westward. We are seldom out of sight as we travel on this grand track towards the Ohio, of family groups behind and before us, some with a view to a particular spot, close to a brother perhaps, or a friend who has gone before and reported well of the country. Many, like ourselves, when they arrive in the wilderness, or find no lodge prepared for them. On entering the state of Ohio, we find a country beautiful and fertile, and affording a plain, industrious, and thriving population all that nature has decreed for the comfort of man. It contains rich land, good water, wholesome air, lime, coal, mills, navigation. It is also fully appropriated and thickly settled, and land is worth from $20 to $30 per acre. An advance of 1,000% in about 10 years. The working farmer, by the amount of capital required in England as a renter, may own and cultivate a much better farm in this country. Thus, the poor man who entered his quarter section of 160 acres 12 years ago and had paid $320 for it at the end of five, has supported his family during this time and now finds himself worth from $3,000 to $4,000 besides his movable property. Such is the natural progress of an Ohio settler. As we proceed, our astonishment increases at seeing so much done in so short a period. A gentleman, who is now our companion of the way, travelled 12 years ago on this same track. It was then little more than an Indian path through the wilderness, though now it is a string of plantations with but little intermission of uncleared tracts. Maurice Birkbeck.
In the year 1817, a British Quaker and agriculturalist named Maurice Birkbeck, along with his family and several fellow religious idealists, immigrated to the United States, intent on establishing a utopian agricultural community somewhere in the Illinois Territory. As his party traveled westward, Birkbeck kept a journal detailing his experiences of the journey, which he later published under the title Notes on a Journey in America from the Coast of Virginia to the Territory of Illinois. Birkbeck's journal is one of many firsthand migrant accounts that vividly capture the relentless and fervent course of America's westward expansion in the early 19th century, as seemingly unending wagon trains of American settlers pursuing the dream of land ownership that had been out of reach for them in the eastern and southern states, as well as European immigrants seeking the religious freedom, individual liberties, and economic opportunities they had been denied in their home countries, crossed the Appalachians and the Ohio River into the bountiful and verdant country of Ohio, the gateway to America's first western frontier. It was a time fueled by nationalistic fervor, feelings of immense possibility, and the anticipation of unimpeded transformation. Only 5 years before Maurice Birkbeck's party set out on their journey, Eastern North America had been set aflame by the outbreak of the War of 1812, as the United States and Great Britain vied once more for imperial dominion on the continent, and a powerful confederacy of indigenous nations under the leadership of the Shawnee warrior Tecumseh, allied with the British to defend their ancestral homelands against continued American encroachment, and sought to establish a permanent Indian country along America's western frontier that would forever confine United States territory to the east of the Appalachians. But by 1815, hostilities between the United States and Great Britain had ended. The young American nation had emerged from the war with its territory fully preserved, and Tecumseh lay dead in an unmarked grave, his Confederacy defeated, and his dream of a permanent Indian nation shattered. the consequences of the war were utterly devastating for the surviving native peoples on the western frontier, especially those in the Ohio country, including the Delaware, Miami, Odawa, Seneca, Shawnee, and the most venerated of the Ohio tribes, the keepers of the Council Fire, the Wyandot. Now in turmoil and depleted on what remained of their Ohio territory, and suffering civil strife over their divided loyalties during the war, the Wyandot and the other indigenous nations of Ohio now found themselves overrun by an unrelenting flood of westward migration of white settlers, who now viewed the Ohio country as theirs for the taking. In 1817, the same year Morris Birkbeck's party traveled through Ohio on their way to the Illinois Territory, American officials forced the Ohio tribes onto dwindling land reserves in northwest Ohio with the signing of the Treaty of Fort Meigs. For most of the Ohio tribes, the treaty only intensified their deep distrust of the Americans and reinforced their fears that they would never be able to preserve their traditional lifeways so long as they remained in Ohio, and that the only hope for the survival of their people would be to leave Ohio to resettle in the Indian Territory beyond the United States' western borders. But for the Wyandot, the treaty would end up leading to their renewed prosperity as a nation. On their Grand Reserve in Upper Sandusky, the Wyandot would create a thriving community that embraced the agrarian ways of their white neighbors while remaining rooted in the ancient customs of their people. They would become among the most educated and wealthiest people in the state of Ohio, and, for a brief time, offer a glimpse of how the Indian policy first set forth by President George Washington, which envisioned a future in which Native peoples and American settlers lived peacefully side by side, could have come to fruition. This is part two of our five-part series on the history of the Wyandot in Ohio, with guest experts Chris Houck of the Wyandot Nation of Oklahoma.
Hello, my friends. My name is Two Paz, is my Wyandot name, Two Lives. I am Wyandot, and I'm of the Big Turtle Clan.
And renowned Ohio historian Mary Stockwell, author of the book The Other Trail of Tears, The Removal of the Ohio Indians.
I'm a longtime resident of Ohio, and I have a PhD in American history. I was a professor for many years at Lawrence University, and I trained with some of the top guys in the American West. So the frontier in the West, to me, is synonymous with America.
In part one of this series, we learned how the Wyandot and the other indigenous nations of Ohio came to reside in the Ohio country in the early 18th century, how the American Revolutionary War was in part a battle over possession of the Ohio country, and how the Ohio tribes' fierce resistance against American settlement in their territory after the Revolutionary War nearly defeated the young United States, before General Anthony Wayne's victory against the tribes at the Battle of Fallen Timbers and the signing of the Treaty of Greenville that followed, in which the tribes agreed to allow American settlement into nearly three-fourths of the Ohio country, and to confine their own settlements to Northwest Ohio, which remained designated as Indian Territory. Today, these pivotal events in American and Ohio history have been commemorated with numerous historical markers and monuments erected at the very sites where they took place, such as Fallen Timbers Battlefield Park in Maumee, where markers and interpretive panels situated throughout the park trail relate the story and significance of the battle to visitors, and in Greenville, Ohio, where several markers near where Fort Greenville once stood tell of how the historic treaty signed within its walls opened much of Ohio to American settlement, precipitated Ohio statehood in 1803, and ultimately advanced the formation of the present-day United States. But most of these markers are conspicuously silent on a critical question underpinning these events that it is imperative we understand if we are to truly appreciate the magnitude of their historical significance. What became of Ohio's native peoples after the signing of the Treaty of Greenville? While it is generally known that the Indian Removal Act of 1830 eventually resulted in the forced removal of the Ohio tribes to Indian Territory in present-day Kansas and Oklahoma, the story of the nearly half century after the signing of the Treaty of Greenville, during which the tribes continued to live alongside American settlers in Ohio, remains relatively obscured. It is this story that we will explore with Chris Hauck and Mary Stockwell in parts 2 through 4 of our series on the history of the Wyandot in Ohio. Perhaps no Native nation more compellingly captures the complexities, contradictions, and tragedies underlying this tumultuous transitional chapter in Ohio history than the Wyandot, the last of the tribes to leave Ohio in 1843, by which time they had become an integral part of American life in Upper Sandusky and had become among the most prosperous people in the state of Ohio. Through the prism of the Wyandot story, we can glimpse into the astounding ingenuity and resilience of the Ohio tribes, as well as the divergent paths they took and their determination to preserve their tribal cultures and identities, while adapting to the existential challenges brought on by the unrelenting pace of change on the Ohio frontier in the 18th and 19th centuries.
Ohio, everything changed. All this happened in 100 years, between 1730 and 1843. A lot changed, everything.
The ending of the Northwest Indian War in the Ohio country, marked by the signing of the Treaty of Greenville in 1795 that designated an official boundary line between Indian and American territory in Ohio, had ushered in an uneasy peace on the early American frontier. With the fighting over, the Wyandot and the other Ohio tribes returned to their principal villages and settlements in Northwest Ohio on the Indian side of the Greenville Treaty line. And for a brief moment, it seemed as if the ancient rhythms of life had been restored for the tribes, as they continued their ancestral lifeways and cultural traditions, much as they had for thousands of years, even if their once vast territories had been diminished in ways previously unimaginable. The Wyandot and the other Ohio tribes also maintained regular peaceful contact with American officials, as under the terms of the Treaty of Greenville, the tribes received assistance from the U.S. government in the form of yearly annuities in money and material goods. To make up for any shortfalls in the annuities, the tribes could also trade the furs they collected on their hunts for additional goods and supplies at the many government-run Indian trading posts established along the Ohio frontier, which had been a fixture of U.S. Indian policy since the presidency of George Washington. The tribes were also permitted to cross the Greenville Treaty line into American territory as needed, particularly for hunting, provided they made no attempts to permanently settle there. But even as American officials earnestly worked to uphold the terms of the Treaty of Greenville and maintain the fragile stability that had been established in the Ohio country, they were also under constant pressure from a growing contingent of American citizens who demanded that Northwest Ohio also be opened for settlement. Although much of the area was still predominantly comprised of a vast and intractable wetland, today known as the Great Black Swamp, enterprising settlers knew that if the swamp could be drained, the submerged land beneath could be converted into abundant farmland. In defiance of the federal government, some American surveyors and settlers determined to stake out their own claims to the famously productive land surrounding the Great Black Swamp, simply began illegally crossing the Greenville Treaty line into Indian territory, especially once Ohio became the 17th U.S. state in 1803. Within a decade after the signing of the Treaty of Greenville, the treaty line had already become something of an empty promise, as it became increasingly clear that while the U.S. government might be able to preserve the Greenville Treaty line on paper, it was much more difficult for them to enforce on the ground, as the chaotic and unrelenting tide of American settlement stretched ever westward, seemingly propelled by the invisible force of what later came to be known as manifest destiny, the belief that the creation of an American empire spanning the North American continent was preordained. Implicit within the ideology of manifest destiny was the assumption that American civilization was bound to eventually dominate or even eradicate the cultures and traditions of the native peoples who had resided in North America for thousands of years. But in the earliest decades of the 19th century, the U.S. government was still committed to exercising what they believed to be a humane Indian policy, first set forth by President George Washington, that recognized indigenous peoples as the rightful owners of the North American continent and sought to acquire their lands through negotiated treaties in exchange for yearly annuities provided to the tribes. At the time, it was thought that this policy would inevitably lead to Native peoples being incorporated into the American experiment and to the eventual merging of white and Native peoples under one shared national identity. As American surveyors and settlers continued to encroach onto Indian territory following the Treaty of Greenville, American officials, determined to prevent further violence between white settlers and Native peoples on the western frontier, came to the Wyandot and other Indian nations of Ohio, as well as the tribes of the Michigan and Indiana territories, to negotiate additional land cessions that would, they hoped, achieve the dual aim of shielding the tribes from the aggression of white settlers, while also expanding U.S. territory. The tribes, upholding the promises they had made at the Treaty of Greenville to never again take up arms against the United States, and also fearing further eruptions of violence if they refused, were left with little choice but to agree to the land cessions. This resulted in the signing of additional treaties at Fort Industry in present-day Toledo in 1805, at Detroit and Brownstown in the Michigan Territory in 1807 and 1808, and at Grouseland, Vincennes, and Fort Wayne in the Indiana Territory between 1803 and 1809, in which the Wyandot and several other Indian nations, among them the Chippewa, Delaware, Kickapoo, Odawa, Miami, Munsee, Potawatomi, Seneca, Shawnee, and Waya peoples, collectively ceded millions of additional acres to the United States in exchange for more annuities and under terms comparable to those in the Treaty of Greenville. Hopefully, the tribes reasoned, assenting to these additional treaties would insulate them from the unremitting flood of American settlement that seemed to inch closer to them every day. But even this wasn't enough. In Ohio, it seemed that no matter what concessions the Wyandot and the other tribes made, it would not satisfy the insatiable multitudes of American settlers who seemed intent on surrounding them and demanding still more, in clear violation of the treaties of Greenville and Fort Industry. Astonished at the rate by which the Americans flooded into their territory and fearing that they would soon be completely overrun, in 1810, the great Wyandot chief, Tarhe the Crane, along with eight other Wyandot chiefs, delivered a petition to Ohio Governor Samuel Huntington, imploring him to intervene to stop his people from settling in Indian territory.
Father, we the chiefs and women your children salute you, and we take this opportunity to let you know that some of your people have encroached upon our lands, and it is probable that you've heard nothing about it. They have been surveying and measuring out lands on this side of the line, and now, Father, we apply to you for assistance. We understand that you're appointed to govern, rule, and correct the people of this state. You remember the Treaty of Peace concluded at Greenville, that we should consider the United States people as our father, and we to be considered by them as their children, and we hope that the Great Spirit will keep this good peace in our hearts. Our Father told us at the treaty that those of his people living near us should see and take care that no person or persons should meddle with or encroach upon our lands. And Father told us that his people are a very greedy people, and that if a trader would come looking at the land and ask for a little to plant on, our Father told us to tell them no. And if anyone came to trade without license, we should let our Father know of it. We understand that you are to take care of your people to the line, and if they transgress, you are to correct them. Father, we would wish you to send out papers with orders upon them for those people not to encroach upon us, to show and convince the people that this is contrary to the law to meddle, settle, or survey land over the line. Father, we your children salute you with our compliments, and may the Great Spirit bless and assist our Father, and we his children, that we may live together in peace.
The protests of the Wyandot did little to curtail the advancing encroachment of American settlers onto Indian lands in Northwest Ohio. It was in the midst of this crisis that a young, magnetic Shawnee warrior named Tecumseh, guided by the prophetic visions of his younger brother, Tenskwatawa, who had come to be known simply as the Prophet, began making impassioned appeals to the many Indian nations across the western frontier, calling for united armed resistance against the continuing American invasion of their territories. If they were to preserve the cultures and sovereignty of their peoples, Tecumseh asserted, the Indians must think of themselves as one people not separate tribes, and form a mighty confederation of warriors that would send American settlers fleeing back across the Appalachians and secure a permanent Indian homeland on the western frontier. Several thousand Indian warriors from tribes across the frontier joined in Tecumseh's campaign, and soon the frontier was engulfed once more in bloodshed as Tecumseh's confederation began launching deadly attacks on American settlements. This eruption of violence on the American frontier would lead in large part to the War of 1812.
To me, if you want to explain the War of 1812 in the West, just say Tecumseh. Tecumseh, this young warrior, last to leave the battlefield at Fallen Timbers, he never accepts the Treaty of Greenville. So between 1805, 1810, he puts together this huge confederation. All the northern tribes, some of the southern tribes he's going to get. And he says the Ohio country belongs to us, our nation state. I'm going to launch a massacre on one day and wipe you guys out, and you'll flee back to the Appalachians, back to the East Coast. This country will be ours. So his confederation leads in great measure to the War of 1812. He's got to get the British on his side because somebody has to spline the guns. You can't win this with bows and arrows. And the British are kind of delirious. This might clinch that Canadian border all the way to the Ohio River.
Officially, though, it wasn't Tecumseh's confederation that was the chief cause of the War of 1812, but rather the aggression of the British Empire. With the Napoleonic Wars raging in Europe, the British had imposed a blockade of all ships bound for the European continent, in the course of which they seized hundreds of American ships on the Atlantic Ocean and impressed thousands of American sailors into the service of the Royal Navy, deeming them to have been born subjects of the British King. Seeing these acts as a blatant violation of their national sovereignty, the United States officially declared war on Great Britain in June of 1812. But the Americans also knew that the British, from their territory in Canada, were supplying Tecumseh and his warriors with the guns and other munitions they then used in their attacks on American frontier settlements. The British had still never lost sight of their designs to claim the Ohio country for Canada, or to even retake all the territory they had surrendered to the Americans in the Revolutionary War. They therefore saw Tecumseh's Confederation both as a natural ally in their ambitions to once again control much of eastern North America, as well as a protective shield that could insulate Canada from American aggression. For the United States, then, defeating Tecumseh's Confederation became tantamount to also taking Canada and expelling the British once and for all from North America. These were the many interweaving causes of the War of 1812 that engulfed the American and Canadian frontiers in brutal warfare between Tecumseh's Confederation and the British Army on one side, and the American Army of the Northwest under the command of General William Henry Harrison, who had fought Tecumseh once before at the Battle of Fallen Timbers, on the other.
So the war goes on, and the War of 1812 is the two-front war. We fight the British on the high seas to the east, but we fight Tecumseh and his British allies to the west. And the two young men who fight at Fallen Timbers, Harrison and Tecumseh, are going to have to fight it out down the road.
But not all Indian nations on the frontier were aligned with Tecumseh's Confederation. For the Wyandot and the other Ohio tribes, Tecumseh's war against the Americans not only engulfed their Northwest Ohio homelands in violence once again, it also caused bitter divisions within the tribes, pitting older chiefs who were still committed to upholding the Treaty of Greenville, in which they had promised to never again take up arms against the United States, against young and idealistic warriors captivated by Tecumseh's vision of expelling the Americans and creating a permanent Indian country on the western frontier.
Tribes split in two. The older chiefs tend to say, we're done, we ended at Greenville, we're allies, stop killing. And Tecumseh, no, we're going to take one last try.
For the Wyandot, Tecumseh's legacy is complicated by the civil war he ignited between the Wyandot peoples of Ohio and Michigan during the War of 1812. The great elder Wyandot chief, Tarhe the Crane, exerted his influence to largely keep the Ohio Wyandot on the side of the United States. And upon the outbreak of the war, he sent a young Wyandot chief named Between the Logs to an intertribal council in Brownstown, Michigan, to deliver his speech entreating the tribes not to ensure their own destruction by siding with Tecumseh.
Brothers, the red men, who are engaged in fighting for the British king, listen. These words are from me, Tarhe, and they are the words of the Wyandots, Delawares, Shawnees, and Senecas. Our American father has raised his war pole and collected a large army of his warriors. They will soon march to attack the British. He does not wish to destroy his red children, their wives, and families. He wishes you to separate yourselves from the British and bury the hatchet you have raised. He will be merciful to you. You can then return to your own lands and hunt the game as you formerly did. I request you to consider the situation and act wisely in this important matter, and not destroy your own people. Brothers, I am directed by my American father to inform you that if you reject the advice given to you, he will march here with a large army. And if he should find any of the red people opposing him in passage throughout this country, he will trample them under his feet. You cannot stand before him. I earnestly entreat you to consider the good talk I have brought and listen to it. Why would you devote yourselves, your women, and your children to destruction? Let me tell you, if you should defeat the American army this time, you have not done. Another will come, and if you defeat that, still another will appear that you cannot withstand. One that will come like waves of the great water and overwhelm you and sweep you from the face of the earth.
But in the end, Tarhe was not able to persuade the Wyandots still living in Michigan, who, under the leadership of Chief Roundhead, sided with Tecumseh.
When the War of 1812 rolled around, the Michigan Wyandots, those that remained up there, sided with the British. Roundhead, who was one of the chiefs in Michigan, a big player, he sided with Tecumseh. Tecumseh even said at one point, he says, "I'm not a great war leader." That's Roundhead. He's the strategist. And anyway, they broke the Treaty of Greenville, which led up to the River Raisin and then the ensuing massacre after the fact, which so horrified the nation. But those were the Michigan Wyandots. And Tarhe and the Ohio Wyandots sided with the Americans because they'd signed an agreement.
The River Raisin Massacre, in which warriors of the Michigan Wyandot and other tribes of Tecumseh's Confederation slaughtered American soldiers who had been captured during the Battle of the River Raisin near Monroe, Michigan, occurred in January of 1813, just as the tide in the war began to turn against Tecumseh and the British. While in the months following the outbreak of the war, they had successfully beaten back American attacks on Canadian territory and taken a number of American military forts on the western frontier. In 1813, the Americans began successfully repelling their incursions. And after Commodore Oliver Hazard Perry's victory in the Battle of Lake Erie in September 1813, Tecumseh's Confederation and the British were forced to retreat back into Canada, with William Henry Harrison's army in pursuit. In October 1813, the Americans achieved a critical victory at the Battle of the Thames in Upper Canada, during which Tecumseh was killed.
Eventually, as the War of 1812 progressed in the Old Northwest, we ended up in Upper Canada around Moravian Town with the Battle of the Thames, where Tecumseh and Roundhead were both killed.
The British suffered further defeats in 1814. In July of that year, William Henry Harrison and Lewis Cass, governor of the Michigan Territory, met in Greenville, Ohio, with many of the tribes of Tecumseh's Confederation to negotiate what would come to be known as the Second Treaty of Greenville, in which the tribes agreed to not only end all hostilities with the United States, but to side with the Americans in any fighting that continued along the western frontier. And in the South, an American militia under Colonel Andrew Jackson, along with the Indian warriors of the Lower Creek and Cherokee, who had allied with the U.S., defeated the Upper Creeks, who had allied with Tecumseh, and beat back British attempts to capture territory in Florida and Alabama. In the Treaty of Fort Jackson that followed in 1814, the Creeks were forced to cede 23 million acres of their land to the United States. Even though the British managed to capture and set fire to Washington, D.C. in late August 1814, just weeks after the Treaty of Fort Jackson, subsequent American victories at the Battles of Baltimore and Plattsburgh in September successfully expelled the British from the northern states and forced them back into Canada.
1812, Tecumseh wins everything. 1813, William Henry Harrison defeats him. Tecumseh dies. 1814, Andrew Jackson defeats Tecumseh's allies in the South. And the United States I believe, wins the War of 1812.
Even as the American capital burned and battles continued to rage on American soil, American and British officials had begun meeting in Ghent, Belgium in August 1814 to begin the long process of negotiating an end to the War of 1812. It was clear that neither the United States nor Great Britain had truly gained an upper hand in the war, with neither side having yet taken any new territory. For the Americans, though, the death of Tecumseh and the defeat of his Confederation ensured that the threat of a permanent Indian country preventing continued U.S. westward expansion beyond the Appalachians had been extinguished. The peace negotiations between the British and the Americans finally culminated in the Treaty of Ghent, in which both nations agreed to permanently end hostilities on the North American continent and to define and permanently preserve the boundaries between Canada and the United States. The treaty was signed in December of 1814 and received in Washington, D.C. in February 1815, when a humbled American president, James Madison, officially declared the end of the War of 1812.
James Madison, his launching us into that war almost lost the Western country. And I sometimes think he was a bit arrogant when he went into the War of 1812, like, oh, this is going to be over quickly, because he almost saw the entire Western half of the U.S. broken off and handed back to Great Britain. So when he read the Treaty of Ghent, which is signed in 1815, and it was, oh, we're going to live in peace together, he was delirious. That's an amazing treaty. The British, the Americans, say we will never fight again. Never. And they say we're never going to use the Indians again to fight. So it's 60 years of near constant fighting, and finally the U.S. wins.
Once again, though, the Wyandot and the other Ohio tribes, along with all indigenous peoples on the American frontier, found themselves excluded from treaty negotiations between the Americans and the British that would determine the fate of their homelands. However, just as the Treaty of Ghent had stipulated the preservation of American and Canadian pre-war boundaries as a condition of peace, it also stipulated the condition, codified in Article 9 of the treaty, that all Indian territorial boundaries on the frontier would be reset to exactly as they had been before the war in the year 1811. Determined to implement Article 9 as soon as possible, in the summer of 1815, President James Madison sent American officials William Clark and William Henry Harrison to Portage des Sioux near St. Louis and to Springwells near Detroit to sign new treaties with the tribes of the Western frontier that would reaffirm America's commitment to preserving their territorial boundaries and to bringing the tribes back under the protection of the United States.
Soon as James Madison gets the treaty, he sends William Clark, of Lewis and Clark fame, out to Portage des Sioux, out in Missouri, and they signed treaties with all the tribes, and it's simply, we are going to find a way to live in peace. He sends William Henry Harrison up to Spring Wells, outside of Detroit. He writes peace treaties with all of Tecumseh's allies, and he says, we're going to figure out a way, no more killing.
At the council at Spring Wells, the Wyandot chief, Tarhe the Crane, delivered a message on behalf of the Ohio tribes, who had largely remained loyal to the United States during the war, to the chiefs of the many tribes who had sided with Tecumseh, calling for the healing of the divisions that the war had created among their peoples, and urging the restoration of peace with the Americans.
Brothers, I salute you all. I salute you from the bottom of my heart. I rejoice that I meet you here, and return thanks to the Great Spirit that we meet in peace. Hearken to me, who am about addressing you on behalf of 17 fires and 4 tribes, the Wyandots, Delawares, Shawnees, and Senecas, tribes who have sided with the 17 fires, and consider them as one with them. Listen to us, the 4 tribes. We speak on behalf of all of the 17 fires. You, brothers, who have been on the other side of the river, I address myself particularly to you. You appear to look dark, brothers, as you sit before me. Your eyes are dimmed with tears, and you cannot see aright. We have had a quarrel. That quarrel has caused your sorrow. I must now proceed to clear your sight. I shall do so in a manner and language of our forefathers, in the language which the Great Spirit gave to them to heal their difficulties and speak peace. I take this wampum into my hand. The Great Spirit gave it to his red children to speak with. It was the language of our forefathers. With it, as the emblem of the softest and whitest cloth, I wipe your eyes and the eyes of your women and children, that you may all see clear again. Brothers, listen on. The same cause which prevented you from seeing prevents you from hearing. I now take the emblem of the softest and finest feather and clear your ears, that the words of your brothers, the Americans, may penetrate your ears and sink deeply into your hearts. Your throats, too, have been stopped. You cannot speak the truth, and you cannot speak kindly to your brothers. With like affection, I now clean your throat with the softest and whitest cloth. Your hearts also, in consequence of the disorganization of your senses, have been perverted. I now place them aright, that you may not only see, hear, and speak kindly to your brother Americans now, but in all times hereafter. Brothers who have been hostile, in consequence of the war and sickness which have raged, the bones of your friends are scattered over the earth. I will now gather them together and deposit them in one grave, that your minds may be at rest hereafter. I now bury them and smooth their graves, that posterity traveling over them may not, by observing the protuberance, remember their former animosities. Brothers, listen. I hope you will still attend to my words. I have collected and buried the bones of your deceased friends, and I have smoothed over their graves. I have done so by the emblematic language which the Great Spirit gave to his children. I now take into my hand a whiteboard, and with it I cover the bones of your friends. The board the Great Spirit gave, the sun will not warm through it, nor can the rain wet through it. It will preserve the remains of your friends dry and secure.
And finally, all of the chiefs, whether they were for or against Tecumseh, say, it's over. This endless fighting is over. We got to figure out a way to live together. The time of war is over once the War of 1812 ends. And now the attitude of the government has to be, still, how do we figure out how to live together? It's the president who sets the policy with his secretary of war, starting from Washington. It's, we fight if we have to, but we've got to, when the war is over, forgive and forget. There's no sense of we're going to wipe each other out on either side. There's always a sense of we got to figure a way to live together.
But almost immediately, it seemed, after the signing of the treaties of Portage de Sioux and Springwells, all hopes the United States government had for peace with the tribes on the western frontier were at risk of being jeopardized. The ending of the War of 1812 reinforced many Americans' convictions that the westward expansion of the United States was divinely sanctioned and inevitable, and what had already been a torrential tide of American surveyors and settlers migrating westward on the frontier before the war now only intensified. Perhaps nowhere did this renewed flood of migration threaten to completely overrun Native peoples at this time, more so than in Northwest Ohio, where the legal boundary preserving what remained of the territory of the Wyandot and the other Ohio tribes was increasingly ignored until it seemed that it might disintegrate altogether. The influx of illegal settlement in Northwest Ohio also led to increased contact between the Ohio tribes and American settlers, often with deleterious consequences for the tribes. Struggling to provide for their people in between government annuity payments, chiefs increasingly resorted to going into debt to unscrupulous traders in order to obtain needed goods and supplies for their people. The peddling of whiskey on the Ohio frontier, which had already been a long-standing problem for the tribes, became even more pernicious after the War of 1812, intensifying the scourge of alcoholism among young Indian men in particular. And the occurrence of random acts of violence and thievery committed against Native peoples by land-hungry settlers was becoming more common. American officials witnessing this assault on the Ohio Indians were becoming increasingly alarmed that it was no longer just the tribe's territory that was at risk of disappearing, but their very existence and survival as a people. Resolved to achieve a lasting peace on the western frontier before yet another war broke out, James Madison's successor as U.S. President, James Monroe, sought to advance an amended U.S. Indian policy that he hoped would ensure the protection and survival of an increasingly vulnerable Indian population while also appeasing the unrelenting demands and territorial aggressions of white settlers. Much like that of his predecessors, Monroe's Indian policy sought to purchase land from the tribes through negotiated treaties and annuities. but it also applied the Land Ordinance of 1785 to carve out permanent reserves where the Indians could live within the broader territories they ceded to the United States. Knowing of the dire situation facing the Ohio tribes, Monroe looked to Northwest Ohio as the initial proving ground where his new Indian policy could be implemented.
And James Monroe, a forgotten president, I've come to really admire. James Monroe is the president who says, back to Washington, we've had a good Indian policy. We're trying to be humane. Yes, we're going to buy land and we're going to give annuities and we're going to trade and live in peace. But when we write these treaties, we never tell the Indians where can they live. We just assume the West is so big they'll find a place. And he said, why don't we start putting in actual reserves? There's an actual attempt to figure out, maybe in Ohio, we've got some time to figure out a way where we can all live together before another war would break out.
Monroe's Indian policy was officially put into effect in September of 1817, when American commissioners Duncan MacArthur and Lewis Cass convened a council with the Wyandot and the other Ohio tribes at Fort Meigs in present-day Perrysburg to negotiate what would come to be known as the Treaty of Fort Meigs, or...
The actual title is the Treaty at the Foot of the Rapids. That's what it was always called. The experiment is here at Fort Meigs. In 1817, thousands of Indians are called together with American negotiators, and the United States is buying most of Northwest Ohio. But they take the Land Ordinance of 1785, this grid system that you can see from the air when you look, this is how we survey and sell the West, and they say, where are the tribes living right now? Well, the Ottawa are in what's East Toledo, and they're down the Maumee River. The Shawnee are down around Wapakoneta. The Wyandot are along the Upper Sandusky. The Seneca, Lower Sandusky, some Delaware. So that treaty actually draws out reserves where the tribes are going to live.
But for the Wyandot and the other Ohio tribes, the lead-up to the Treaty of Fort Meigs negotiations was charged with anguish and trepidation. They knew that this treaty was different from previous ones they had signed. This time, the Americans were not simply wanting to purchase yet more land from them. They were also demanding that they live like them, by permanently confining themselves onto small plots of land where they would be forced to adopt the agrarian landholding ways of the white man to sustain themselves. They knew that signing this treaty would usher in a fateful and irrevocable change for their people, from which there could be no return to living in accordance with the rhythms of the ancient lifeways of their ancestors. And yet, they also knew that if they wished to remain in Ohio as culturally distinct peoples and to preserve what remained of their tribal sovereignty, they likely had no choice but to sign the treaty. John Johnston, the U.S. Indian agent in Ohio, who had been tasked with gathering and bringing the Wyandot and the other Ohio tribes to Fort Meigs for the treaty negotiations, recalled in his memoirs how unnerved and apprehensive the tribes were in their preparations for the proceedings.
In 1817, I was charged by Governor Cass with the management of the Ohio and the Indiana Indians in bringing them to the Treaty of the Miami Rapids. I collected 7,000 with which we moved to the treaty ground. In a few days, the whole were assembled at our encampment, a grand council held. The result was that they did not intend on leaving that place until they made a sacrifice to the Great Spirit. I urged in the council to omit this on the present occasion, that we were then behind our time several days, that we were suffering for want of provisions, that the commissioners of the United States were anxiously waiting for us, as no business could be done before our arrival, that plenty awaited us the moment we reached the treaty ground. The council decided that the Indians could not leave the spot until they sacrificed, and requested me to write to the governor their determination and to ask for some things which they needed to complete their arrangements for the sacrifice, namely tobacco and some white muslin to dress the priests. We wanted flour, meat, and salt for provisioning our party, all of which I wrote for. The commissioners, on the receipt of my communication, were indignant at the delay. They would send us nothing but the provisions, writing me positive orders to bring the Indians on immediately, that they could not wait the delay of their sacrifice. The chiefs were called together. The commissioner's letter read and explained, to which they instantly replied that they could not and would not go to the treaty ground until after they sacrificed, that the Great Spirit would not aid them, and that if they were not indulged in doing what they had always been accustomed to do on entering on any important business, they would forthwith return home. The result was communicated to the commissioners with an earnest request that the Indians be indulged in what they believed to be a conscientious duty, that the articles wanted might be sent up, and that I would hurry the arrangement. The commissioners finally assented to my request and forwarded the articles ordered. The Indians held their sacrifice, after which we proceeded in a body to the treaty. We remained on the ground 6 weeks. We procured a large cession of country, and all of us, white men, connected with the service, elated with our success. All northwestern Ohio was at this time ceded to the United States.
After days of contentious negotiations with the American commissioners and disputes amongst themselves that nearly derailed the entire proceedings, on September 29, 1817, the Wyandotte and the other Ohio tribes finally agreed to sign the Treaty of Fort Meigs and the Greenville Treaty Line, which for over 20 years had legally designated all of Northwest Ohio as Indian Territory, was dissolved. Now all that remained of Indian land in Northwest Ohio were the small township reserves on which the tribes had just agreed to permanently settle. The Wyandotte, whose young chief Between the Logs had vehemently protested the signing of the treaty, could at least take some solace in the fact that the Americans, in recognition of their venerated status among the Ohio tribes, had granted them the largest of the reserves established in the treaty. Known as the Grand Reserve in Upper Sandusky, it was situated on richly productive land that was distributed in parcels for private ownership among several chiefs and 176 Wyandotte men and women, all of whom were named in the treaty.
And the jackpot is a place called the Grand Reserve in what's now Upper Sandusky. This 12-mile by 12-mile square block has got the blackest soil on the planet. The Wyandotte get the best land. If you want to see it, drive south, drive from Toledo to Columbus, swing around Upper Sandusky to US 23 in the spring, and you will see that black soil. So that's what they all get. Everybody gets something, and everybody gets more annuities. And it's an amazing forgotten treaty. It's an experiment in trying to live side by side with each other.
However, it would be mistaken to think that the United States viewed the Treaty of Fort Meigs solely as an instrument by which to protect the Ohio tribes and preserve peace between Native peoples and white settlers on the Ohio frontier. For President James Monroe, equally vital imperatives behind the treaty were opening the rest of Northwest Ohio for American settlement, thereby securing control over a critically important region that, with the draining of the Great Black Swamp, would connect and unify America's expanding territory on the western frontier. The treaty also removed the potential threat of future hostilities with the Ohio tribes by pressuring them to become landholding cultivators of the soil, laying the groundwork for their eventual integration into American society.
From several of the Indian tribes inhabiting the country bordering on Lake Erie, purchases have been made of lands on conditions very favorable to the United States and, as it is presumed, not less so to the tribes themselves. By these purchases, the Indian title, with moderate reservations, has been extinguished to the whole of the land within the limits of the state of Ohio and to a part of that in the Michigan Territory and of the state of Indiana. By these acquisitions, and others that may reasonably be expected soon to follow, we shall be enabled to extend our settlements from the inhabited parts of the state of Ohio along Lake Erie into the Michigan Territory, and to connect our settlements by degrees through the state of Indiana and the Illinois Territory to that of Missouri. In this progress, which the rights of nature demand and nothing can prevent, marking a growth rapid and gigantic, it is our duty to make new efforts for the preservation, improvement, and civilization of the native inhabitants. The hunter state can exist only in the vast, uncultivated desert. It yields to the more dense and compact form and greater force of civilized population. And of right, it ought to yield. For the earth was given to mankind to support the greatest number of which it is capable, and no tribe or people have a right to withhold from the wants of others more than is necessary for their own support and comfort. James Monroe.
While Monroe viewed the Treaty of Fort Meigs as a pioneering achievement toward a more humane and sustainable Indian policy on the part of the United States, there were those within the U.S. government who already viewed the treaty not as an end in itself, not as a momentous step forward in achieving a lasting peaceful coexistence with Native peoples on the Ohio frontier, but as an incremental step in the inevitable and far more sweepingly nationalistic project of removing Native peoples entirely from the territory of the United States. Among such early proponents of removal were Lewis Cass and Duncan MacArthur, the very commissioners who had negotiated the Treaty of Fort Meigs with the Ohio tribes, who even proposed the idea during the treaty proceedings, much to the shock and indignation of the tribes.
Honorable John C. Calhoun, Secretary of War, St. Mary's, September 18, 1818. Sir, accompanying this, we have the honor to transmit to you a treaty yesterday concluded by us with the Wyandot, Shawnee, Seneca, and Odawa tribes of Indians. The proposition to remove to the west of the Mississippi was made to the three former tribes, and enforced as far as we believed it politic to enforce it. It was received by them with such strong symptoms of disapprobation that we did not think it proper to urge them too far upon the subject. The time has not yet arrived for them voluntarily to abandon the land of their fathers and seek a new residence in a country with which they are unacquainted and among powerful and hostile Indians. As our settlements gradually surround them, their minds will be better prepared to receive this proposition, and we do not doubt but that a few years will accomplish what could not now be accomplished, except at an expense greatly disproportioned to the object. The treaty now concluded requires few observations from us. We trust all its stipulations will be found in strict conformity with our instructions. Lewis Cass, Duncan MacArthur.
While James Monroe's administration celebrated the Treaty of Fort Meigs, for the Wyandot and the other Ohio tribes, it was utterly devastating. They knew that in signing the treaty, they had just given up their freedom in Northwest Ohio and severed their connection to the ancient lifeways of their ancestors. For them, the treaty was only one more in a long line of broken promises made to them by the Americans. What reason did they have to believe that this treaty was any different, and that it would somehow keep the U.S. government from eventually returning and demanding that they give up even the marginal reserves that were now all that remained of their Ohio homelands?
It reduced us down to specks of land. That was really a pretty devastating treaty. What are you going to do? You either go along because you can't fight, because we're upholding the Treaty of Greenville. We're not going to fight you. The Wyandots have signed, if I remember, about 19 treaties with the United States government, and every single one was broken. But all the way back to 1795, we've held up our end of at least that treaty. So we ended up getting cut down further and further and further. If you look at the maps of what we had after the Treaty of Fort Meigs, it's horrible. It took all this land, even though we'd been reduced, it just took it all away. I believe we were still able to hunt and things like that, but that was about it. We weren't allowed much.
The greatest opposition was experienced from the Wyandots, who by the cession were cut off from the lakeshore and placed 60 miles interior. They reserved a spot of 160 acres on Sandusky Bay for a camping place in their occasional journeys to visit their friends in Canada. The attachment of the Wyandots was ardent for their native country. The night they agreed to give it up, many of the chiefs shed tears. John Johnston.
Despite the traumatic consequences of the Treaty of Fort Meigs for Ohio's native peoples, James Monroe genuinely believed the treaty to have been made in the best interest of the tribes, and that it was the most humane means by which to ensure their continued survival in Northwest Ohio. So when the Wyandot, led by the young chief Between the Logs, came to Washington, D.C., insisting that his people had not been granted enough land to live on, Monroe's administration agreed to his demands for new treaty negotiations. In the Treaty of St. Mary's, signed 1 year later in the fall of 1818, the Wyandot's Grand Reserve was expanded by over 55,000 acres, and they were granted an additional reserve of 16,000 acres at the headwaters of the Blanchard River, known as the Big Spring Reserve, along with an additional $500 in annuity payments. All told, the Wyandot and the other Ohio tribes received increases of several thousands more in annuities and over 100,000 more acres of land, bringing the total amount of land granted for tribal reserves in Northwest Ohio to over 300,000 acres.
Now the Wyandot are angry because they said still not enough land. They go right to meet with Monroe. They go right to talk to John C. Calhoun, his Secretary of War, when he was still a nationalist and cared about the U.S. He wasn't the nullifier yet. They go right to the Senate, and they talk to the Land Committee of the Senate, and they said, we need more land. We need more money. And the Treaty of St. Mary's is written a year later. The Wyandot get now not just the Grand Reserve, they also get Big Spring. They get the little Cranberry Reserve. The Delaware gets some more land. Everybody gets a little bit more money. The Seneca get more land.
And as a reflection of Monroe's administration's commitment to protecting the Ohio tribe's remaining territory, the treaties of Fort Meigs and St. Mary's both use the Land Ordinance of 1785 to safeguard the new Indian reserves from the avarice of American settlers and ensure they would remain under the permanent ownership of the tribes.
The Land Ordinance, which is this grid pattern laid out across the country, it was drawn very clearly around these reserves. You could leave to hunt, you could leave to travel. They went to Washington back and forth, but this was yours to do with what you will. And the goal was nobody can come and take that land from you. You can't sell it. Indians were never allowed to sell their land individually because the government thought, well, my gosh, in 3 minutes, the land will be sold out from under you. So you've got to sell it back to the U.S. government. Monroe thought, and many of the Wyandot agree, eventually these reserves are going to be broken up into individual farms, and then those farms will be handed down to the children of the Wyandot, and they will keep it permanently.
Yet the treaties stopped short of offering American citizenship for the Ohio tribes. This omission would prove consequential down the road, though in their determination to preserve their national and cultural sovereignty, the tribes themselves likely wouldn't have wanted or accepted American citizenship at this time, even if it had been offered.
This is the mistake they made. Under whose laws? They never offer Ohio citizenship, they never offer American citizenship, which I think would have been the next step, but that's many years down the road.
Foundational to James Monroe's Indian policy was the innate conviction that the survival of the Ohio tribes and other native peoples across the American frontier hinged on their capacity and willingness to transform, or even wholly abandon, aspects of their ancient lifeways, and to essentially become outwardly indistinguishable from the white settler communities that increasingly surrounded them. In other words, the tribes must conform to American understandings of what constituted a, quote, civilized people. They may be able to hold on to their languages, stories, rituals, ceremonies, and perhaps even their systems of government, but what were once collectively cultivated tribal lands must be converted into permanent patchworks of privately held farms. Men who once lived as great hunters, warriors, and diplomats with dominion over vast territories must become clearers of the forests, tillers of the soil, builders of cabins, and the sedentary masters only of their own individual properties. Women, who were once the principal cultivators of the land and exercised expansive authority in tribal communities, must be relegated principally to the role of homemakers. Children must be educated so as to inherit these predetermined agrarian roles from their parents. and the tribes must forsake their ancient and deeply rooted religious traditions and become God-fearing Christians. To aid the tribes in making this immense transition, in 1819, Monroe won the passage of the Civilization Fund Act, which allocated $10,000 to help the tribes establish the characteristic institutions of white settler communities.
There's a sense that Monroe is saying, it's not just the wars are over, the way you guys used to live is over. You're going to need to settle down in permanent towns. You're already commercial hunters. Now commercial farming begins, and we'll do anything we can to help. He set aside $10,000. He got it from Congress. It was called the Civilization Act. And the idea is, if any tribe needs anything, do you need a doctor's? Do you need schools? Do you need churches? Whatever you want built, come and ask us for that. And we will help you make this transition.
Today, we can clearly see the Treaty of Fort Meigs as having inflicted yet further trauma upon the Ohio tribes by forcing them to abandon the ancient patterns by which they had structured their societies and sustained themselves as a people, and being yet another in a long line of treaties with indigenous peoples that the United States was bound to eventually betray. But at the time, within the context of the seething tensions, clashing cultures, and incidents of isolated violence still occurring between Native peoples and American settlers on the Western frontier, James Monroe genuinely saw his Indian policy, first instantiated in the Treaty of Fort Meigs, as the best hope for achieving peace on the American frontier, and for the eventual integration of Native peoples into American society.
Monroe was like, I know the American settlers are coming your way fast. But hopefully, that dream that we're all going to live together side by side, once they get up to the edges of your reserves and they see how you're living and the wars are over and the killing is over and the massacres are over, his hope was that we'd all respect each other, live side by side. It's rolling the dice on a future that I think was admirable. Not all the tribes would agree with me, but I think we should all live together and figure out a way. So I'm leaning towards I like Monroe's idea.
As we'll learn in part 3 of this series, the period surrounding the end of the War of 1812 and the signing of the Treaty of Fort Meigs is remembered as a time of incalculable hardship for the Wyandot, as many young Indian warriors, finding themselves broken and dispirited by an unraveling post-war world that seemed utterly determined to destroy so much of what had endowed their lives with meaning, succumb to alcohol addiction.
Whiskey was always terrible on the frontier, but it got really worse with the defeat of Tecumseh. Very terrible after the War of 1812. A devastating war for the tribes. I don't think we historians have captured it yet. And that really broke, I think, Native American men, especially throughout Ohio and the Ohio country.
But the fortunes of the Wyandot begin to turn with the arrival of a young Methodist minister named John Stewart on their Grand Reserve in Upper Sandusky.
It was a young man by the name of John Stewart. His parents were freed slaves. This young man converted to Methodism around 1815. He sets up a little shed and he starts preaching about Christianity, and the tribes come and he teaches them the Methodist faith.
And with the arrival of Stewart's successor, the Reverend James Finley, the Wyandot undergo a profound spiritual renewal as a nation. Finley establishes a mission school on the Grand Reserve to help prepare the younger generation of the Wyandot for a future agrarian and industrialized world that would increasingly bear very little resemblance to the traditional Wyandot way of life their parents had known.
He gets up here in 1821 and he builds a mission school. Wyandot children come from Upper Sandusky. He then sets up this farm so that the children can actually support themselves by working there. Many of the Wyandot parents understood, we get what's happening. The next generation down is going to live in a totally different world.
As Finley's ministry among the Wyandot grows, the Wyandot build a mission church on the Grand Reserve, and a great many experience deeply personal conversions to the Methodist faith.
Finley said, I built the school and the farm for the kids myself, but when the church went in, the Wyandot men built it for me. And he converts many to the Methodist faith. He said the stability the Methodist faith brings and the sense of purpose we have. Once they then got their reserve It will give us a spiritual lifeblood to keep going in this place. And they became devout Christians, devout Methodists. And that transformed Wyandotte society.
The Wyandotte's renewed spiritual foundation then enables them to even further transform their society as they eventually become among the wealthiest and most prosperous people in the state of Ohio and forge deep bonds of friendship and kinship with their white neighbors. For a brief historical moment, the remarkable success of the Wyandotte on their Grand Reserve seems to bear out the hopeful vision of James Monroe's Indian policy instantiated in the Treaty of Fort Meigs.
Overnight, they become a truly prosperous farming community that would be the envy of any farming community west of the Appalachians.
The farms and the orchards, there were professionals, doctors, lawyers.
They were so wealthy, and they were few in numbers. There were only about 800. So a lot of these farm owners among the Wyandotte, they would hire either sharecroppers, they had hired day workers, they'd hire farm laborers. There was a lot of intermarriage, too.
We were part of the community. We're prosperous here.
At least half of the tribe and many of their greatest leaders embrace this change. They say, this is tremendous. We will take the next step. There's a tiny time where the experiment seems to be working.
But once prominent members of the Seneca and the Shawnee, who had remained deeply unhappy with their confinement on land reserves in Northwest Ohio, begin to insist that the U.S. government send their people to lands west of the Mississippi, certain American officials, who had long been in favor of Indian removal, seized the opportunity to portray this as proof of the failure of the Treaty of Fort Meigs and to renew intensified debate over the question of Indian removal in Washington, D.C. As growing contingents of the U.S. government begin to call for Indian removal, James Monroe surrenders to the changing political tides and abandons his Indian policy, and with it the experiment enacted in the Treaty of Fort Meigs.
The first cries for Indian removal, this is what surprised me, comes from the tribes themselves. Mainly the Shawnee and mainly the Seneca are saying, we don't want this blended life. We want to be free. Imagine being Monroe. After 8 years, you think your experiment is working, and he abandoned his own policy.
And the election of Andrew Jackson to the presidency in 1828 sets into motion the course of events that would culminate in the Indian Removal Act of 1830. By which Indian removal would become the official policy of the United States government, betraying the promises of the Treaty of Fort Meigs and threatening to unravel everything the Wyandotte had accomplished on their Grand Reserve.
Jackson becomes president, and he's, I want these tens of millions of acres opened up for the people that I represent, the common man and his family and his children. So that's the argument he's making. And he made his great nationalist argument, too, which is, I cannot tolerate having these small settlements. I can't have non-American nations within our nation. If you want to continue being a tribe, you go west, and that will become the foundation of the Indian Removal Act.
Great thanks to our guest experts for this episode of Storied Ground, Ohio historian Mary Stockwell, and Lifeways researcher for the Wyandotte Nation of Oklahoma, Chris Houck. And thank you to our voice actors for this episode, including Lane Hockle, Brad Smith, Matt Sweet, and, from the Wyandotte Nation of Oklahoma, Tarhe the Crane descendant, Colin Gray. I'm your host and producer, Nick Pavlik. Our executive producer is Chris Pfeiffer. If you have any questions, comments, or you want to listen again, go to wgte.org/ground or wherever you stream your podcasts. See you next time.
WGTE. Voices around us.